The means of grace are the very thing that evangelicals are looking for.
Chris Roseborough talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And so in my presentation, we will talk about some of the alternative means of grace that evangelicals have created in their quest to find some kind of certainty of their own salvation. But then we will then explore back and look at what God's Word says regarding baptism, the Lord's Supper, as well as holy absolution as the means by which, you know, these are outside of us, that God gives us signs and assurance that we are forgiven and in Him and have a right standing with Him.
You can meet and hear Chris Roseborough, Making the Case for the Means of Grace, June 10th and 11th at the 2016 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Take off your Roman dresses or have them burned off! Cowards! 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 How dare you! You call yourselves Christians? Christians? You! Why are you standing there? Put out this fire! Run! Bucket, shovels! Run!
Martin, when a limb is rotten, you must cut it off. You know that as well as I.
Get out!
Martin, this is for you! Let it burn!
Get out of Wittenberg before I beat you out!
Beat me out! I defended you! I supported you! I'm carrying on just as you would have!
You think this is my work? This is never my work!
No, it's the people's work! The people's work! It's the people's work! The people's work!
That's a scene from the 2003 Luther movie where Luther encounters Karlstadt after having returned from the Wartburg to Wittenberg. Karlstadt was up to some mischief. Of course, he thought he was doing it in the name of the Reformation. He thought he was doing it in the name of Luther's work. But shortly after this, by the way, this man that had been a defender of Luther had actually been Luther's supervisor at the university, is no longer so much a part of the Reformation, at least the Lutheran Reformation anymore. He's just one of the figures that we'll be talking about in connection with Luther as the Reformation continues to build after Luther's return from the Wartburg to Wittenberg, here in part 14 of our weekly series on Martin Luther and the Reformation. Dr. Ken Sherb will be our guest for the next hour. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in on this Tuesday afternoon, the 1st of March. Dr. Ken Sherb is pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri. He has a PhD in history from Ohio State University and formerly served as a theology professor at Concordia University, Ann Arbor, Michigan, and as an assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Ken, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good day to you, Todd. How are you this afternoon?
Very well. Last time we had Luther coming back from the Wartburg, and he, after some a flurry of preaching that he did there in the Advocavit sermons, he is settling into life once again. How's that for Luther?
Yeah, well, in our last three programs, we've been following Luther in either what he was writing from the Wartburg or, as you just mentioned, what he said when he got back to the pulpit in Wittenberg upon his return there in March of 1522. Today we're going to be talking, Todd, though, about how the Reform movement was gathering steam, especially in the places that would be touched by the Lutheran Reformation. And remember as we go here that Luther, like everybody else we're going to talk about, is just putting one foot in front of the other. There's no long-range plan going here. Luther did immediately have to do some guest preaching in the nearby towns in April and May of 1522, just to make it clear to folks there as well that he was not fomenting rebellion or something like that. Really, he repeated a lot of the same things he had said in Wittenberg in the Advocavit sermons.
So remind us what he said in those sermons.
Well, upon Luther's return to Wittenberg, he addressed confusion and lovelessness there by way of this series of eight sermons that started on the first Sunday in Lent, Invocavit Sunday, 1522. These Invocavit sermons drew attention to two related distinctions in the Christian life: the distinction between faith and love, and the distinction between must and free. In those Invocavit sermons, Luther dwelt at some length on the Lord's Supper, as he warned his hearers against giving offense to the weak, and also warned them against self-righteousness.
So what are we going to say today?
Well, we'll start with the group of people that was coalescing around Luther, with which he had surrounded himself there at Wittenberg. And then we'll kind of take the view, as it were, from 30,000 feet. We'll ask, well, what did the Reformation look like? What were the kind of telltale signs that the Reformation had come to town? And then finally, we will peek at some of Luther's important writings from the years 1522 and 1523 that did help to shape the growing Reformation movement.
All right, let's consider Luther's colleagues there at Wittenberg, if we could, starting with the one who would at length be leaving Wittenberg. That is Andreas Bodenstein von Karlstadt. We've heard of him before, haven't we?
Yeah, we talked about him a couple of programs back. Karlstadt was an interesting guy. He got his own theological doctorate just 2 years earlier than Luther, and he supervised Luther's own doctoral promotion in 1512. Karlstadt was learned. He also had a doctorate in civil and canon law, apart from his doctorate in theology. In 1516, Luther had started to win Karlstadt over from Karlstadt's Thomism by using theological arguments based on Augustine. Karlstadt, by the way, had been the one who was formally invited to debate with Eck at Leipzig, and that's the debate in which Luther also famously joined. We talked about that some time ago. Significantly, though, Karlstadt never saw eye to eye with Luther on the key issue of the imputation of alien righteousness. Instead, Karlstadt kept on stressing the Spirit enabling Christians to fulfill the law. The radical edge to Karlstadt's thinking began coming out while Luther was still at the Wartburg, especially late in 1521 and early in 1522. Karlstadt was aiming at a Christian city of Wittenberg, as it were, configured in accord with biblical law. Karlstadt insisted on the abolition of images, he said, in an orderly fashion. But as soon as he started talking that way, that led to the violent kind of iconoclasm in Wittenberg that alarmed people, alarmed Luther, helped prompt Luther's return. After Luther preached those famous Invocavit sermons in March of 1522, Karlstadt was kind of, shall we say, pushed into the background of things there in Wittenberg. He continued to teach at the university, but he was given no other public leadership role. And over the next couple of years, he published a few things. In 1523, he was, in effect, serving on leave from the university as a vacancy pastor at Orlamunda. He was called to be pastor there in 1524. And that really ended his formal relationship with Wittenberg, but theologically, he had already been out of step with Wittenberg.
Certainly, pride of place among those who stayed in Wittenberg and continued to labor there with Luther goes to a man near and dear to your heart, Philip Melanchthon.
Well, I've spent a lot of time with Philip. He was kind of a boy genius. I mean, by the time Luther returned from the Wartburg, here was Melanchthon at the ripe old age of 25, now in his fourth year of teaching at Wittenberg. Of course, he had been with Luther not only at the university, he had been with Luther at the Leipzig debate in 1519. Remember, Melanchthon had come to Wittenberg to teach in the arts faculty, particularly to teach Greek, but he ended up teaching a wide range of other subjects too, most of them in the arts faculty. He became known as the preceptor or the schoolmaster of Germany. Melanchthon was never ordained, but he did teach theology at Wittenberg. He got his Bachelor of Bible degree at Wittenberg. He started studying for it under Luther's tutelage and that of others, and got the degree a little bit more than a year after he arrived in town in September of 1519. And so that Bachelor of Bible degree allowed him to give cursory lectures on the Bible. By about 1526, the elector just wanted to give Luther some relief, and so he wanted Melanchthon to teach more in theology and take some of the load off of Luther. So Melanchthon, in effect, had a dual appointment at the university, both in the arts faculty and the theology faculty. Later on, famously, he taught a course on the Nicene Creed, which led to a book on the Nicene Creed. He did get married, and it wasn't such of a scandal for him because he was a layman. He married, in fact, the daughter of the mayor, Katharina Krapp, in late 1520. In 1521, he published his Lotzi Communes, a work that Luther said was worthy of inclusion in the canon. It's a little hyperbole on Luther's part. And, of course, famously, we talked about this, when the Zwickau prophets came to town in late December of 1521, he was deeply shaken. Melanchthon did not prove himself to be a very good leader at this time.
Another name that we should mention here is John Bugenhagen.
Yes, Bugenhagen was another multi-talented guy, although in ways different from Melanchthon. Bugenhagen was a priest who had been greatly influenced by the work of Erasmus. And when Bugenhagen read Luther's Babylonian Captivity in 1520, he was very impressed. And he uprooted himself, came to Wittenberg to learn more. Bugenhagen was a biblical scholar in his own right. Eventually, he wrote commentaries on the biblical books of Psalms, Matthew, Jeremiah, Jonah. His Jonah commentary, by the way, has just been translated. He also taught and did administrative work, Bugenhagen did, at the university. In fact, it was his organizational skills that kind of commended him and made him so very valuable. He wrote several church orders, actually traveled to various German cities and territories, even to Denmark, to help organize and implement the Reformation in those places. And in fact, Todd, a lot of the sermons that we have from Luther were preached by Luther as Luther was filling in for Bugenhagen while Bugenhagen was away on these trips. And Bugenhagen became the pastor at the city church there in Wittenberg. Had a reputation which Luther loved to tweak him about for preaching long sermons. But as pastor, and this is really significant for Luther, he was the one who heard Luther's confessions of sin. And Luther continued to take his confession of sin very seriously. Once Bugenhagen said to him, "You know, God must surely be asking himself, what can I make of this man? I have given him so many superb gifts, but now he questions my grace." And evidently that was just the right thing to say to Luther, because Luther said, "For me, this was an immense comfort, like the sound of angels echoing in my heart."
So out of these, is there someone whom we would call today Luther's best friend?
Well, that's a bit hard to say, you know, who was Luther's best friend. But it may have been none of the above, actually. Justus Jonas would be the guy I'd mention, another former Erasmus follower who came to Wittenberg. He was 10 years younger than Luther, was with Luther there at Worms, and he served as a member of the Wittenberg Theological Faculty for years. He was its dean. He was also a prolific translator.
Dr. Ken Sherb is our guest. It's part 14 of our weekly series on Martin Luther and the Reformation. We're talking about the Reformation movement building. When we come back, what legal status did any of the reform activities have in the Holy Roman Empire at that time?
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore, thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. thecleaningauthority.com.
The congregation at Lake George Lutheran Chapel is a proud supporter of Issues Etc. We are located on the western shore of Lake George. With the lake in view, Jesus still teaches from the boat of his church, and the people sit, listen, and are fed by Christ himself through his holy ministry and instituted means of grace. Every Sunday, 9 a.m., set your course to 1540 West 800 North, Fremont, Indiana. Like us on Facebook at Lake George Lutheran and find out more at lakegeorgelutheran.org.
Spiritual and religious. You're listening to Issues Etc.
It is more important to know what the Reformation retained than what it overthrew.
Dr. Larry Rast talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Charles Porterfield Croft made that statement back in the 1800s, but it remains true for us today. The church's job is to confess faithfully, and simply to overthrow error does not establish truth. What we are about is confessing biblical truth, and what this conference promises to do is to help us recover that for an age that desperately needs to hear that truth.
You can meet and hear Dr. Larry Rast making the case for the conservative reformation June 10th and 11th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. on this Tuesday, March the 1st. It's part 14 of our weekly series on Martin Luther and the Reformation with Dr. Ken Sherb. We're talking about the Reform movement building up after Luther returns from the Wartburg to Wittenberg. Ken, all these changes are being made. We're going to talk about them in a minute here, what an observer would have seen happening. But it's important to wonder what legal status any of these initiatives in the direction of the Reformation had in the Holy Roman Empire at that time.
Well, Luther returned to Wittenberg in March of 1522, less than a year after he famously appeared at the Diet of Worms, and the Edict of Worms was still in full force against him. In January of 1522, already before Luther came back to Wittenberg, Frederick the Wise's cousin, the very anti-Luther Duke George of Saxony, had gotten the Imperial Regency Council to make a decree against innovations that would go counter to traditional Christian usage. Specifically, several bishoprics were instructed to suppress, and if necessary, suppress by force, anything new, for example, in the celebration of the Mass. And the Imperial Regency Council said that no change would be permitted until a general church council said that those changes would be okay. However, in the Imperial Diet of 1522, the meeting of all the bigwigs, like Luther had addressed at Worms the previous year, the Diet declared that it was impossible to enforce the Edict of Worms, that is, wipe out the growing Lutheran movement. The Diet actually tabled consideration of the Lutheran question until a free Christian council could take place in Germany. They said, hopefully within a year. Well, there was no such thing within a year. But the Diet there did, in effect, open up a little wiggle room for reforming activity to proceed. And that's important for us to bear in mind here because we're going to be talking about various kinds of reforming activity.
So in general, how would an observer have noticed the Reformation at work in these years, 1522, 23, maybe even 24?
Well, this is an interesting exercise. I do it sometimes with my Bible class here. And I should mention, we'll be speaking in broad terms, terms actually that would maybe not have even been as applicable to a place like Wittenberg, where Frederick the Wise was in charge, as to the imperial free cities like Nuremberg, which was quickly, by the way, becoming a hotbed of Lutheranism at this time. So what I do with my Bible class here is I ask people, okay, if you came to town, if you came, for example, to Nuremberg, and you just observed what was going on in town, if you didn't talk to a soul, if you just observed things with your own eyes, how could you tell that the Reformation was taking hold?
Well, the wishes of the aforementioned Duke George of Saxony notwithstanding, I would imagine that there would have been changes at least in the Lord's Supper.
Yes, yes. Two directly observable changes. First, communion in both kinds. Now remember, Luther had said in the Invocavit sermons he wanted to go slow on this, and yet he never waffled about the fact that this was a must. This was not something free. This was a must. It's a biblical mandate. Christ said, do this, eat and drink. And so that was something that it would have been encouraging to see, and it would have shown that the Reformation was coming to town. Another would have been the abolition of the Mass, which is to say, the Mass was no longer being seen as a sacrifice for sins. And again, you could tell that just by sitting in the back at church during that particular part of the service when the words of institution came, and if you had a stopwatch, you wouldn't even have to understand the language. Just hold your stopwatch on it and time it. Because if that lengthy prayer, the canon of the Mass, was gone, then the Reformation had struck. See, in Luther's Latin Mass of 1523, the words of institution directly followed the preface after a short pause. No more canon of the Mass.
I imagine another no-brainer would have been that since Luther had written so extensively about monasticism, that people would be leaving monasteries, convents, things like that.
Yeah, many would be leaving. At the very least, nobody would be under compulsion to stay. And unlike what Karlstadt wanted, at least in the Lutheran Reformation, religious artwork, much of which would be at the monasteries, would be left intact. But monasticism itself was a very different story.
What else would the observer see?
Well, that the clergy were being taxed and made responsible to civil courts. This was something Luther had been calling for as far back as 1520 in his address to the Christian nobility of the German nation. There he said, "The clergy do not belong to a separate and holy social order or class. They are not above civil law. There is nothing to set these clerics apart but their call and office."
So with the mention of that document, the address to Christian nobility, Luther, I think, there denounces various ways that the church tried to manipulate civil power, exercise civil power. With that in mind, what else would we expect to find at this point in the Reformation?
Well, there would be an abolition of appeals to foreign courts. That would almost always have meant ecclesiastical courts in Rome. Luther wrote in 1520 that no temporal matter should ever be referred to Rome. And that all sorts of ecclesiastical jobs, support-type positions, should be given to local people wherever possible. That way, see, the bishop's secretary wouldn't be somebody appointed by Rome, maybe even somebody appointed from Rome. And there'd be various boards of supervisors being established for church property and other things, such as what we might call welfare.
Well, in that vein, in that document, the Christian nobility document, Luther calls upon the ruling class there in Germany, this sounds odd to our ears, to abolish begging. What was behind that concern?
Yeah, it's not that Luther was unconcerned about the poor, but he understood that begging was seen as a meritorious work in the sight of God, a work of apostolic poverty. And it was given respectability through the various mendicant or begging orders like the Franciscans. Luther had said back in 1520 that the mendicant order should have no new houses built for them, and the monks that were already there should be consolidated into fewer houses, or maybe the houses should be dissolved altogether. Luther had said in 1520 that begging should be abolished. He said each city should take care of its poor in an organized way, not haphazardly, for begging is not any form of the gospel. It is not a meritorious work before God to beg, nor is it to give to a beggar. Poor relief, therefore, needed to be placed under the secular authorities where it belonged. Now, as Christians, these secular authorities would want to do everything they could to help their neighbors, and yet Luther had written already in 1520 that no one should get by living idly and just live on the labor of others. He quoted from 2 Thessalonians, "Whoever will not work shall not eat."
Any other visible indicators that the Reformation had come to town?
Well, especially under Lutheran auspices, you would have seen that public schools were being established. Luther had been mentioning the need for educational reform for years. It goes already back to the 1520 writing to the Christian nobility. And then in 1524, he followed up with another one to the councilmen of all cities in Germany that they establish and maintain Christian schools. And there he called for the formal schooling of girls as well as boys. And by the way, this is the treatise where Luther made the famous remark that the gospel is like a passing rain shower. It's raining on us big time right now, but if we don't respond to it, it's going to pass on and go someplace else, he says.
So we've highlighted here just some of the earmarks that the Reformation had come to any given place. And even though we have had the Lutheran Reformation particularly in view, if we're up there at that 30,000 feet looking down, these things are also happening elsewhere, aren't they?
Yeah, and other places from that height might look similar. In other places, the Mass was being abolished, there was communion in both kinds, people were leaving monasteries, just about everything we've said here. And these things would have been, as I say, not the case only at, say, Nuremberg, but also Strasbourg, or even in Swiss territories. And that, Todd, made it a bit more difficult to sort out, and we'll have to see how this did get sorted out, when there became many others like Karlstadt, that is, people who were opposed to Rome, no doubt about it, and yet also, in one way or another, opposed also to Luther.
Dr. Ken Sherb is our guest. It's part 14 of our weekly series with him on Martin Luther and the Reformation. Today, the Reform Movement builds. Folks, if you're a fan of Reformation history, you do want to hear Dr. Larry Rast's presentation, Making the Case for the Conservative Reformation, at the 2016 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 10th and 11th in Collinsville, Illinois. In addition to Dr. Rast, you will meet and hear Chris Rosebrough, Adrian Dorr-Heinz, Pastor Brian Wolfmiller, Carl Fakencher, and Jonathan Fisk. Registration for the conference is $100 and includes three meals. You can find out more by calling 618-223-8385 or visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 10th and Saturday, June 11th in Collinsville, Illinois. When we come back, what was Luther preaching during this time? Stay tuned.
I like to think of the deaconess vocation as driven by two things, the love of Christ and the needs of our neighbor.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. James Buescher, Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the vocation of deaconess.
First, the deaconess is moved by the love of Christ, who came not to be served but to serve. Yet I think we can also see the profound needs around us, broken families, loneliness, despair. Deaconesses help the church to become a true family that manifests the love of Christ in our love for one another and especially for those in need.
For more information on the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit ctsfw.edu or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155.
Do you dread going to work out?
Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth. Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.
Sophisticated Lutheran Apologetics. You're listening to Issues Etc.
In my family, education means cultivating wisdom and virtue by teaching what is good, true, and beautiful. Memoria Press makes this type of education possible with their classical Christian curriculum. Characterized by simplicity, quality, and affordability, Memoria Press gives my children a rich classical education. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR.
For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Lutheran Talk.
In Lutheranism, I come as a guilty sinner in need of hearing the forgiving words of Christ every single time I gather. Every single time.
Lutheran Music. The new Lutheran Public Radio app. Download for iPhone, Android, Windows Phone, and Kindle at issuesetc.org.
We're talking about the Reformation movement building after Luther returns to Wittenberg after about a year at the Wartburg in part 14 of our weekly series on Martin Luther and the Reformation. Dr. Ken Cherb is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We've talked about some of those influences and some of the things that concerned Luther here. Putting Luther back in the pulpit, if we could, Ken, what was he, after he preached that initial series of Invocavit sermons, what was he preaching on after that?
Well, eventually, here's the pattern Luther got into for preaching. On Sundays, he would typically preach on the appointed lessons, the gospel lessons, the epistle lessons. But during the week, he could choose his sermon texts more freely, and often he would just preach through a biblical book at weekday services. And within Luther's lifetime in general, it's interesting that when a major event occurs, particularly one that takes him out of the pulpit and out of his classroom for a while, it's interesting to see what he takes up when he gets back. Well, in this case, after Luther did his little spate of guest preaching during the spring of 1522, he kind of settled down to preaching on Sundays in Wittenberg on 1 Peter. And he went through Sunday after Sunday after Sunday preaching through 1 Peter.
Why 1 Peter, do you think?
Well, 1 Peter is one of those books that Luther had written from the Wartburg really shows Christ to you. It's relatively short, of course. It can be treated briefly. But Luther apparently was in no hurry. He may have preached as many as 23 sermons on this little five-chapter book of the Bible. 1 Peter may also, however, have caught Luther's eye as a preaching text for this particular time, because this epistle talks about two subjects that had been very much on his mind at the Wartburg and remain very much on his mind, namely, the priesthood of all believers, and obedience to temporal authorities. Regarding the universal priesthood, Luther said in treating 1 Peter, it would please me very much if the word priest were used as commonly as the term Christians is applied to us. And regarding temporal authority, he said, again in his sermons on 1 Peter, we should be subject to power and do what they order, so long as they do not bind our conscience, and so long as they give commands that pertain to external matters only, even though they deal with us as tyrants do.
Late in 1522, Luther writes a treatise in that vein called Temporal Authority, to What Extent It Should Be Obeyed. What is this book about?
Well, it grew in part out of Luther's frustration that his books, for example, his New Testament translation, on which he had worked so hard, starting back at the Wartburg, and which was now just hot off the press, were being banned in several places by the ruling authorities. So Luther started off this treatise on temporal authority by reflecting that a couple of years earlier, he had tried to tell the Christian nobility what they should do as Christian nobles. But now, he said, he needed to write and tell rulers what not to do. And a big thing that he did not want them to do was for the government, for them as the governing authorities, to encroach on God's kingdom. Luther affirmed that there is a legitimate place for temporal authority and that it does not come by way of the church. And this is a hugely important point for Luther to make. It was not the kind of thing people were used to hearing in medieval times. Temporal authority has been instituted by God, Luther said, not for the sake of governing Christians. As Christians, they need no temporal law or sword. That authority is there to restrain evildoers. Moreover, though, Since no one is by nature Christian or righteous, but altogether sinful and wicked, God, through the law, puts them all under restraints. So they dare not willingly implement their wickedness in actual deeds. So see, Christians come under a government authority too, government restraint, but it's insofar as we are sinners.
In this treatise on temporal authority, Luther urges people to distinguish between, and you mentioned this just a moment ago, temporal government by external law and spiritual government through the gospel. What's that about?
Well, Luther is doing that, but he's not trying to play one of those off against the other, and I know you realize that. He says we need both. One, to observe and preserve external peace. The other, to produce true righteousness. For example, Luther writes in here, no one can become righteous in the sight of God by means of the temporal government without Christ's spiritual government. So, when you need spiritual righteousness, temporal authority itself will not help. But the reverse is also true. When you need external discipline and the restraint of evil, then that's no time for the gospel. Luther says, a man who would venture to govern an entire country or the world with the gospel would be like a shepherd who should put together in one fold wolves, lions, eagles, and sheep, saying, help yourselves and be good and peaceable toward one another. Now, the sheep would not live too long under such conditions, Todd. It would be just as naive, then, Luther suggests, to think that there should be a common Christian government over the whole world, or indeed over a single country or any considerable body of people.
So Luther didn't object to Christians taking part in temporal authority?
No, he did not object to Christians taking part in the temporal affairs of their community, because the exercise of temporal authority is commanded by God. And Luther asks, well, what service of God should Christians not take part in? And furthermore, he noted that wise princes are pretty rare birds. So if a prince should happen to be upright, wise, or a Christian, that's a great blessing. He even terms it a miracle.
Yeah, Luther is also concerned that Christians who do serve as princes or in government should not force anyone to believe.
Right. And that's another huge point on Luther's mind at this time, as the Romanist rulers and government officials were trying to compel people to side with the Pope. So he writes here, it is futile and impossible to command or compel anyone by force to believe this or that. For that matter, he said, in the ultimate, you can't fight heresy with the sword either. And for the very same reason, if you wish to drive out heresy, Luther wrote, you must find some way to tear it first of all from the heart. With force, you will not stop it, but only strengthen it.
Now, switching gears from government to church, Luther about this time was also drawing out the implications of the priesthood of all believers. You mentioned before he preferred that term, priest. What should we observe here?
Well, in the sermons on 1 Peter, Luther had noted just what this priesthood of believers does: offer spiritual sacrifices, pray to the Lord, and proclaim his word. A priest is God's messenger, he told his hearers as he was preaching. Thus, you should also teach other people how they too come into God's marvelous light. You know, he's talking about the passage in 1 Peter about God who has called us out of darkness into his marvelous light. He's made us a holy priesthood. Writing to Christians in Bohemia in 1523, Luther connected the priesthood of Christians to the priesthood of Christ himself. He said, Christ is a priest, therefore Christians are priests. Wherefore, we are priests, as he is a priest, sons as he is a son, kings as he is a king.
Now, Luther's writing this to those Bohemians. He's trying to encourage them to call their own pastors instead of relying on the Roman bishops to ordain pastors for them. How did he go about this?
Well, he says, the keys belong to the whole church and to each of its members. Sometimes you'll hear people say today, oh, the keys belong to the whole church, but that doesn't mean to the members. Well, that's not what Luther said. He said, there is no other word of God than that which is commanded to be announced by all Christians. There is no baptism than the one which any Christian can confer. There is no other remembrance of the Lord's Supper than what any Christian can do, what Christ instituted to do. There is no other kind of sin than that which any Christian might bind or loose. That gives the church the basis on which it can call pastors. In fact, the fact that the keys are in the hands of every Christian makes it necessary, in Luther's book, to call a pastor and to have a pastor, because no one should arrogate to himself what belongs to all. Now, elsewhere, Luther makes it clear that the office of the ministry is a matter of divine order. Here he's stressing simply that it's a matter of order. But he doesn't leave out the divine order. In fact, we've already seen him teaching that the office of the ministry is indeed instituted by God.
Dr. Ken Sherb is our guest. We'll come back 10 more minutes with him. And this is the 14th part of our weekly series on Martin Luther and the Reformation. I'm Todd Wilkin. Stay tuned. Joining us each week through the November elections, journalist Molly Hemingway of The Federalist and Mark Hemingway of The Weekly Standard.
I don't think anybody who's thinking rationally actually thinks that Donald Trump would be good on issues of marriage, abortion, religious freedom.
It's been reported that, you know, one of the few soft spots in Trump's support among Republicans is that of weekly churchgoers.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth, issues, etc.
Deaconesses are women trained to share the gospel of Jesus Christ through works of mercy, spiritual care, and teaching of the Christian faith. The word deaconess means servant. Find out more on how you can serve in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod through the vocation of deaconess at lcms.org/deaconess. Working in faith, laboring in love, remaining steadfast in the hope of our Lord Jesus Christ. LCMS Deaconess Ministry. lcms.org/deaconess.
An oasis in the desert of pop American Christianity. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Augsburg Lutheran, Shawnee, Kansas. Peace Lutheran, Fresno, California. Trinity Lutheran, Casper, Wyoming. Memorial Lutheran, Houston, Texas. Trinity Lutheran, Gillette, Wyoming. Our Savior Lutheran, Ridgecrest, California. St. Mary's Lutheran, Des Moines, Iowa. Redeemer Lutheran, Caucabeca Falls, Ontario, Canada. St. Jacoby Lutheran, Shawano, Wisconsin. And St. John's Lutheran, North Prairie, Wisconsin. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support, the Issues Etc. 300. The Lenten hymn, O Sacred Head Now Wounded, sung in German by the Capella of Concordia University Chicago. It's playing right now at our 24/7 sacred music station, Lutheran Public Radio. You can access that any time of day or night via the LPR mobile app or go to LutheranPublicRadio.org, LutheranPublicRadio.org, sacred music for the world following the course of the church year. 10 more minutes in part 14 of our weekly series on Martin Luther and the Reformation with Dr. Ken Sherb. We're talking about the Reformation movement building. Ken, as usual in the last few minutes, you'd like to summarize where we've been so far today. What would you say?
After Luther's return from the Wartburg, a group of people was coalescing there in Wittenberg who would be Luther's colleagues in the church and at the university for the rest of his life. the spread of the Reformation to various cities and territories entailed not only theoretical, theological change, but also observable differences in church and community life. And during 1522 and 1523, by preaching and writing on subjects such as the Christian's relation to temporal authority and the priesthood of all believers, Luther ended up shaping the growing Reformation movement more and more. Now, Todd, let me turn this around on you and the audience and put some true or false items to you. So, number one, true or false. The early 1520s was a time of change in the University of Wittenberg theology faculty. True. Karlstadt left, in effect, already in 1523, officially in 1524. Bugenhagen, who became Luther's pastor as well as colleague in the university, and Jonas, who became Luther's friend and translator, joined the department at about this time. And, of course, Melanchthon, who had been there since 1518, was still around and would start teaching theology more in about 1526. Second statement, true or false. The Imperial Diet of 1522 gave reforming impulses a bit more breathing room than had the Imperial Council earlier that year. That's true. And it can largely be chalked up to the efforts of the representatives from Electoral Saxony, Luther's own place. The Imperial Regency Council, which was kind of in charge of day-to-day matters while the Emperor Charles V was back in Spain, had made a decree against innovations that went against traditional Christian usage. That is, they were against Reformation-type initiatives. But that was just that little council. Later that year, the big meeting, the Imperial Diet, declared that it was impossible to enforce the Edict of Worms, that is, to completely wipe out the growing Lutheran movement. So the Diet actually tabled consideration of the Lutheran question until a free Christian council could take place in Germany. Now, even though Luther had been ordered not to publish anything new, and by the way, that's a stipulation that Luther ignored, still, he found this an encouraging development. It did leave some room for the spread of reform initiatives. Well, speaking of reform initiatives, my next statement, true or false. One of the outward indicators that the Reformation had taken hold in a particular place was that the clergy were now being taxed and made responsible to civil courts. True. Remember, this was something that Luther had been calling for as far back as 1520 in his address to the Christian nobility of the German nation. Another statement, true or false. Another such indicator that the Reformation had kind of come to a particular place, was the abolition of begging. That, too, is true. Begging was not a meritorious work, not on either end of it, not the person doing the begging or the person contributing to the beggar. Neither one of those was a meritorious work in the sight of God. And therefore, social welfare-type activity was being organized more and more by the temporal authority, by the government. Another statement, true or false. Not long after Luther returned from the Wartburg, he began a sermon series on 1 John. False. And everything was fine with that statement until the very last word. It wasn't 1 John, it was 1 Peter. He gave lectures, by the way, on 1 John in 1527. But at this point, 1522, he was preaching on 1 Peter, another one of what he called the prime and capital books of the New Testament. It had within it subjects like temporal government and the Christian's relationship to it, and the universal priesthood of believers, another thing that Luther was thinking about a lot at the time. These sermons, by the way, appeared in print in 1523, so Luther's sermons, or his sermonic commentary, as it were, on 1 Peter, became, in effect, another one of Luther's books at the time. My last statement for you, Todd, true or false. In On Temporal Authority,
Luther said it would be ridiculous to think there could be a Christian government over a country. That's true. Because Luther said you cannot govern people with the gospel. It would be ridiculous to think that you could. It would be like putting, you know, animals of various sorts, including some who prey on others, all together at the same time and expecting them to be kind and well-disposed toward one another. You need law. You need discipline. And that law and discipline is not distinctively Christian. And this, I think, is a huge point for us even to this day, Todd, because people will sometimes say we need a, you know, a Christian government or something. Well, what would make the government distinctively Christian? And it's really more a comment on these people who are calling for this than it is on government and the needs of government when they say we need a Christian government. What do they think is distinctively Christian? If they think it's adherence to law, however well-motivated and however important that may be in its own place and time, well, it's still giving short shrift to the gospel, which is the distinctive thing that makes Christians Christian.
With that last point there, we can kind of see how it is that the gospel is still running all of this for Luther. He does not want the gospel to be turned into a basis for the exercise of civil and temporal authority. It simply cannot function that way. With all these other subjects that Luther was dealing with after his return to Wittenberg, is the gospel still central in his mind? That is, the changes taking place, all of these things, in the best of all possible ways, does Luther want these things driven, these changes implemented by the renewal of the gospel preaching?
Yeah, and of course, we will have occasion to see as we go along here that not everybody is going to see it that way. There are going to be people who more want, well, like Karlstadt, to kind of whip a community into line with its adherence to the law. This is also the place where the growing rift between Luther and the Renaissance humanists becomes more and more apparent, because he is so riveted on the gospel, and they are more about, again, various forms of good Christian conduct in the world. But yeah, everything Luther is doing here, whether it be continuing to translate the New Testament and promote that translation that he has done, I should say refining the translation that he has done and promoting it, whether it be preaching sermons, whether it be the books that he's writing, even as he encourages people in, for example, his work on temporal authority, not to try and force people, compel people to believe one thing or another. That's all so that the gospel can have free course.
Then finally here, we do have examples, and you mentioned this before, kind of the other streams of the Reformation. Karlstadt is a kind of a rump attempt at an alternate way of reforming. You mentioned, I think, probably alluding to Calvinism, things like that, where they don't get that distinction, where they are trying to press the gospel into service of things it is never intended to do or say.
Yeah, you mentioned Calvin, and of course Calvin won't come on the scene as a reformer. He's alive at this time, but he won't come into his own until several years later. But it is interesting, if you want to kind of distinguish between Luther's kind of reform and Calvin's kind of reform, something that Calvin said on his deathbed versus something that Luther said in the Invocavit sermons. Luther said in the Invocavit sermons that he did nothing, the Word did everything, he sat back and drank good Wittenberg beer with his friends Philip and Amsdorf, and the Word is what did the work. Calvin, on his deathbed, was reputed to have said that when he first came to Geneva, there was nothing. There was preaching, and that was all. But the Reformation still hadn't come to town, in effect, he was saying. Now, that's a huge difference. As far as Luther was concerned, when the gospel is preached, that's the Reformation. That's what's going to give rise to all these other things. As far as Calvin was concerned, the Reformation hadn't really begun until the city of Geneva was being whipped into shape.
With about 30 seconds, where do we go next time?
Well, next time we're going to talk about something specifically that helped the Reformation kind of take wings and move very rapidly in various places, and that was Luther's tremendous attention at this time and work on
liturgy and hymns. The period from 1523 to about 1525 is the greatest spate of Luther's hymn writing in all his life. He wrote hymns later, but he wrote more at this time than any other.
Dr. Ken Sherb is pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri. He has a Ph.D. in history from Ohio State University, formerly served as a theology professor at Concordia University in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and as an assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Ken, thank you.
It's always a delight to be with you, Todd. I'll talk to you next week.
Folks, Concordia Publishing House has produced all kinds of Reformation resources. You can find out more at cph.org or call them 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, Concordia Publishing House. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to get our weekly update on the November elections, especially following Super Tuesday, from journalists Mark and Molly Hemingway. We'll talk with Terry Mattingly about media coverage of religion, and we're going to discuss the resurrection body. Pastor James Douthwaite will be our guest tomorrow on Issues Etc. So what we're seeing here is that the Reformation moves slowly. It moves ahead by fits and starts. It wasn't a revolution. It was the slow and constant teaching and preaching of the central article of the Christian faith and of Scripture, justification by grace through faith for Christ's sake alone, Christ being preached. That's what it was. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Do you want a church with a rockin' band and a sermon series to help you live a better life? It's not here. Bethany Evangelical Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights offers authentic, historic Christianity to a world awash in fads and entertainment, and offers forgiveness of sins to people overwhelmed with guilt and shame. Join us Sundays at 9:30 on Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights, Illinois, to receive the life-giving gifts of God with us. Find out more online at bethanylcms.org.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.